This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to turn our sights across the pond to talk to an expert on the European scene about what's happening with complementary and alternative medicine and integrative medicine over in Europe. He is Rob Verkerk. He's a PhD graduate of Imperial College in London, and he's scientific director of ANH USA, the Alliance for Natural Health, of which I'm a board member. You've heard me talk about it frequently. But he's also the executive director for ANH International. You see, this is a group that has its roots not just in the United States, but across the world. And they have a specific branch in Europe where they're struggling to preserve the rights of people to access complementary medicine, healthy food, natural treatment in the European continent. So without further ado, here's our guest, Rob Verkerk. Rob, it's a pleasure talking to you. You're over there in London as we speak.
Absolutely. Ron, fantastic to talk to you. And the first thing I should say, obviously, is that our involvement with a base in the UK covers a lot more than just Europe, but we are looking at challenges that are being faced all over the world. And you know, right now, for example, South Africa is facing a really big challenge as they're trying to superimpose an EU-style regulatory framework on the South African system that will impact both the kind of nutraceutical integrative medicine community, but also traditional systems of medicine that have existed there for hundreds of years.
Well, let's situate the conversation around this EU issue, because what used to be called the common market, of course, is now called the EU, the European Union. And there's a lot of tussling and headlines about the strains in the edifice of the EU, you know, with the Greek financial crisis. But the implications of it are specific for our field of medicine, the field of medicine that our constituency enjoys, natural medicine, because, you know, while we're faced with regulatory challenges in the United States, the EU has some very tight constraints on what can be done in the field of natural products and in the field of natural treatment. So what's going on over there?
Well, it's been going on for a very long time. The reality is that back in 1965, when thalidomide struck, they developed the European Medicinal Code. And essentially what they did is create a code for drugs that would require an incredibly stringent testing system that is really on par with what you have in the United States. But they didn't create a specific carve-out that would legally provide you with the exemptions that you have through Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. So essentially, you've got this medicinal law with an incredibly broad definition that is used as a, you know, an arbitrary and loaded gun by regulators whenever a natural product that starts to compete with a drug comes into play. And the culture is very much a sort of dobbing in culture. So if a drug company doesn't like something, it goes through the revolving door that exists with one of the national regulators, makes a complaint, and the next thing that you know, that either a particular practitioner who's using that product or a company that's selling the product, either as a retailer or as a manufacturer, gets a nasty letter through the post and is challenged to effectively prove that their product is not an unlicensed drug.
So the impression that I think a lot of Americans have is sort of a romantic impression of what goes on in Europe, that Europe is a free fire zone. There's a lot of freedom, that herbal medicine is highly regarded. Certainly there's a tradition of homeopathic medicine, natural medicine in Great Britain. And is this a misimpression? I mean, are some things better and some things worse? Is it harder to get certain things over there or easy to get certain things over there?
The reality is it's by and large harder to get certain things, but coming back to the earlier point is that the traditions are very, very strong, and of course they are strong both from the point of view of the fact that there is a very rich natural medicine tradition that exists through herbalism. It obviously has evolved in many different ways. Obviously, homeopathy, whether you're looking at Germany, France, or the UK, is also strong. Typically, homeopathy is kind of viewed slightly outside of the scope of natural medicine because it's because of the dosages involved. But what has basically culminated is that you have now 28 different member states, each with their own national laws, and of course a European treaty, most recently the Lisbon Treaty, the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, that is endeavoring to try and create a single market. That's the development since the original days of the European Economic Community. And so you've got this interplay between, on one hand, laws that are trying to create a free marketplace for the trade to effectively remove barriers to trade within Europe. Very often that plays out as a very protectionist system for, say, US products, because they'll decide quite readily that, no, we don't like products coming in from the US, so we'll use our arbitrary loaded gun to shoot those down. So, you know, we've been involved in cases where there have been huge seizures. One particular seizure involved $400,000 worth of products that were coming in into Europe that were largely classified as unlicensed medicines. On the other hand, you've got this desire to try and create a single market. And you've got, strangely enough, within the European Court of Justice, that's the equivalent of the Supreme Court, that's the highest court based in Luxembourg, that is attempting to meter out how this treaty should function. And of course, what it has done is come down fairly hard on regulators, national regulators in Germany, the UK, Finland, Denmark, and elsewhere, where they are being too stringent over limiting the use of certain products. So you can look at whether it's garlic. You know, there was an attempt by Germany some years ago to try and medicalize any garlic sold in tableted or encapsulated form. And it was the European Commission that took the German government to court and said, look, guys, we need to understand, if you're going to classify this as a drug just because it's in a capsule or tablet, it is a food effectively, that makes pretty much everything that goes into a capsule or a tablet a drug. Fortunately, in that case, and this is really why it's so important to take strategic legal actions, the European Court found that the product was in fact a food, and putting it in a capsule or tablet was nothing other than a delivery system. So there's been this sort of range of cases that are very positive and quite liberalizing, and in other cases, particularly where they threaten major drugs in the area of cancer or type 2 diabetes, that have been very, very restrictive.
Well, forgive us, you've been stateside, you know, you come back and forth regularly. What are some of the things that we have freedom to use in the United States that you can't use over there, and vice versa? Are there things that you're free to use in Europe, in certain European countries, that are verboten in the United States?
Well, you know, if you look at hormonal products, that's probably one of the classic areas. You can, in the States, you can buy your melatonin anywhere.
Mm-hmm. You can go DHEA, things like that.
Yeah, yeah, anything that's hormonal in Europe is essentially classified as a medicine. And that's partially because the only carve-out for foods in Europe exists through a European directive called the Food Supplements Directive. And that directive essentially defines supplements, equivalent of dietary supplements, as substances that have a nutritional or physiological effect. And of course, everything has a physiological effect, so they focus more on the nutritional side of it. And they
in other words, if it works, then it's forbidden. As long as it doesn't work, it's okay to use. It's a catch 22.
That's often the case. I mean, if it has therapeutic value, it's regarded as having a pharmacological action, and therefore definitely makes it a drug. But if it is a nutritional or physiological substance, it can be a food supplement, which is essentially a carve-out of food legislation, not drug legislation. And of course, they generally assume that means it needs to be a normal component of the diet. And that's where the glandulars, if you like, and the hormonal products get left out in the dark.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people in the United States are apprehensive, because it seems that more and more we're moving towards kind of a world government scheme. Recently, there was a trade agreement that was much criticized, but eventually looks like it's going to be passed, the TPP in the United States. And it suggests that there's going to be a great deal of what's called harmonization of regulations. A lot of people say, hey, that's not going to benefit the U.S. because the regs are more stringent elsewhere. We don't want to be France. We don't want to be U.K. We want to be, have the freedoms that we enjoy traditionally in the United States. Is there any danger that Europe will become a template for more regulation in America?
I think there's every bit of evidence that suggests that the European model is the lead model. And where do we get that information from? Really, essentially, if you look at what has been going on in the deliberations in the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which is the intergovernmental organization that manages effectively the food trade, including increasingly the food supplement or dietary supplement trade, you'll see that Europe essentially controls the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Particular Dietary Uses, essentially has is always looked to as the primary guide in terms of what is going on. I think some view what has been happening in Europe as relatively progressive, in the sense that it could have medicalized everything and is still choosing to have an interpretation that considers some products as a subset of food legislation. However, the difficulty we have, as soon as you start getting to really therapeutic products, they're immediately classified as medicines.
So you mentioned Codex Alimentarius, and that's a big bogey for a lot of people here in the United States, because they point to the Codex as some sort of international conspiracy that will drastically curtail our access to supplements, and that it's coming down the pike, it's inevitable, and there will be some draconian new laws under Codex. So literally, some people are fundraising under the specter of pushback against this Codex, which is emanating like a dark cloud from Europe.
Yeah, it certainly is heavily controlled from Europe. I think the other aspect to consider is that the U.S. government is extremely involved in the development of Codex recommendations, guidelines, and essentially, at times when you sit through Codex meetings, you'd be hard pushed to put a cigarette paper between the difference in view between the European Commission, that represents, you know, half a billion consumers across the 28 member states of Europe, and the FDA delegation that represents the U.S. government. And of course, the other governments that exert a lot of power there are Canada and Australia. So it's essentially somewhat of an Anglo-Saxon conspiracy. The notion of it being a conspiracy, I think, is quite realistic, because a lot of it is so untouchable. Essentially, you have annual meetings, and most of the key decisions that are made between the government's presence at present and the trade associations have been made before the meeting. So if you rock up as an observer and sit and observe, even if you are a minor trade association that could have some input, or an environmental consumer group that could have some input, you will be largely talking to yourself, because the decisions will have been made. Another interesting phenomenon is you could potentially have a situation where the small countries were to outvote the large countries, because it's based on a consensus voting system. And the bottom line is that there is a bully boy tactic that is an operation that, again, behind the scenes, if small countries are to step out of line with this sort of general process of dumbing down the global food supply and increasing the amount of food additives and increasing the amount of pesticide residues and adding GMOs to the equation, which is the sort of general drive that Codex is moving into, those countries are likely to face sanctions. So I think a conspiracy is a pretty accurate way of defining what is going on. I think at the other side of it is to recognize that it is also not directly a system of laws. It is a system of recommendations and guidelines that laws can be aligned with. And in fact, the policeman in the whole system is a privately run organization called the WTO. And that's where the TIPP and other trading bloc harmonization approaches are so much of concern, because they will just align to keep things that are consistent with the pattern of globalization that has been witnessed over the last two or three decades, that tends to favor very large transnational corporations. It favors essentially a model in which it makes sense to have people disempowered, eating fairly low quality foods that increase the rates of chronic disease and maintain a status quo, so that, you know, the drug companies and the seed companies and the big food companies can carry on doing their thing.
Well, the new trade agreement, some people are fearful that the TPP may be a Trojan horse for more supplement regulations, or for less stringent guidelines about food, allowing the proliferation of GMOs, allowing higher thresholds for pesticide and herbicide residues, and food colorings and additives that we don't like.
Well, that certainly is the case. I think the only positive thing about the addition of, or the adulteration of, our food supply through the addition of artificial chemicals is that the European view on them is probably more stringent than the U.S. view.
No, and that's really my impression, because, you know, the one thing about European food is it's generally fresher. It's generally less laced with additives, although this is, of course, changing, unfortunately, with modernization. But Europeans seem to have an aesthetic about their food that's very different from Americans. Americans, you know, just kind of plunged headlong into this chemicalization of our food supply.
Yes, and you have a number of large supermarket chains that are now trying to reach the mass market with healthier offerings. I think by and large, yes, if you look at even products that come out of the dietary supplement industry into Europe, they have a series of colors and flavors, and, you know, artificial colors and flavors and preservatives in them, they'll often not be particularly well accepted by the European public. European public has long preferred to have food that is clean, ingredients lists that are short, very little in the way of hidden ingredients. And that's one of the reasons that Europe, basically through public pressure, has managed to maintain this notion of mandatory GMO labeling. A lot of Americans think that we've been...
Let me get this straight. So in Europe, there is GMO labeling. In other words, the products that are made with GMOs carry a specific admonishment that they have GMOs within.
Correct. There has been since 2003. And of course, when legislation first came in, what happened is that a number of large food companies thought, right, we've got the legislation. All we have to do is put the fact that it contains genetically modified organisms on the label as required by the law, and bingo, we'll be selling GMOs alongside non-GMO foods. And, of course, what they hadn't banked on, and this is one of the reasons that you got such a lot of pressure against mandatory GMO labeling in the US, is that people wouldn't touch the stuff that had the GMO label on it. And, right. And of course, Monsanto, Pioneer, BASF, and the rest of them know that only too well. What has happened as well in Europe is that the animal feed also requires compulsory GMO labeling.
Mm, okay.
Because animals can't read, and because farmers want to give the most available and cheapest feed to their animals, 85% of the compounded animal feed in Europe is now GMO.
Wow. With the products disclosing that the animals are fed GMOs, is that correct?
No, there is no.
Oh, okay. So that's the way that finds its way into the human food supply. Okay, got it.
Again, reminding us that labeling is the key to this whole issue. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in Ireland, there's been quite a tussle about whether, and you've had the similar issue with bovine growth hormone and other issues in the United States, but whether it's going to be legal to indicate to the consumer that whether or not a food has been fed a GMO feed. And what we're seeing now is an increasing drive towards more transparency. The Irish government, in this case, allowing the fact that you can stipulate if it's been fed non-GMO feed. The animal product is the result of animals that haven't been fed GMO feed. And we even have one chain of supermarkets in the UK now that says they have a commitment, even in their non-organic lines, bearing in mind that if a food is certified organic, it cannot be a GMO food. But even in its non-organic lines, it is only using animals that have not been fed GMO feed.
So this is a very interesting experiment, because here, there's no GMO labeling on this side of the pond. Over there, there's GMO labeling. And GMOs have become literally a pariah for consumers, and really kind of is a model for what GMO labeling will do to consumer awareness. And that, I think, is why these big agribusinesses are literally spending tens of millions of dollars and more to influence legislators by lobbying and through public relations campaigns and through election campaigns, where there are votes in various states and localities about labeling, to push back against the labeling, because they know that once consumers become aware that the product is a GMO-containing product, that they're going to reject it.
Correct. And that's also why they're spending so much money trying to re-educate the consumer.
Yeah.
That there is no risk involved in consuming GMO foods. They're trying it every which way. They know full well that once you have the United States, as well as Europe, having mandatory GMO labeling, there is absolutely no way that the remaining countries around the world won't follow suit.
There's plenty of scientists for hire who will be happy to attest to the benign characteristics of GMOs, but part of ANH's campaign, both in the United States and internationally, is to highlight concerns. See, look, I personally, I'm not entirely sure on a scientific basis about some of the arguments pro and con, but I think that there's sufficient doubt to at least enable consumers to make a choice whether they want to consume these foods until the science has been better vetted.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable position. I cannot see any argument to not disclose to the consumer that the food has been created by some means other than conventional means. And, it is really pulling the wool over the eyes of the consumer, and people should have the right of informed choice. I personally take a slightly different position. I believe, based on the fact that the vast majority of GMO foods really are comprised of just two traits, either the Roundup resistance or the Bacillus thuringiensis endotoxin that tackles butterfly and moth pests.
There are real concerns about both issues.
Exactly. If you look at the wider issue, you have to look at not just the health of potential health effects. You have to look at the environmental consequences, which include, of course, the consequences of creating super weeds and super bugs. And then the third issue that you have to look at is the way in which the whole centralization of the agricultural resource is changed by making increasing numbers of farmers dependent for staples on seeds from a very small handful of companies. And in fact, it's that latter argument when you look at the world's most comprehensive international study on looking at the role of GM in actually providing food for the 9 billion that we expect to have on the planet by 2050, that was the absolute, you know, slam dunk argument against GMOs. And that was the ISTAT report. You can pick it up on Google. If you go to look up agriculture at a crossroads, you'll see the 2,500-page report comprised of the results of scientists from 60 different countries, 400 scientists from 60 different countries deliberating on this issue over a five-year period, looking at all of the evidence. And the, you know, the shift to a limited agricultural resource controlled by a small number of countries, particularly because that would also dismantle the agroecological model that creates sustainable farming systems in the developing world where the real population growth is to be felt. That's where it really matters.
It's the ultimate vertical monopoly, and it's a real choke point for worldwide development. It all has to pass through the portals of a few corporate entities that control this.
Correct. And as for this notion on the health effects that various leading protagonists of GMOs in the United States and in Europe, and let's bear in mind, there are a number of UK governments that are massively pro-GM, and the UK government is one of those. They consistently say, well, we've got all the human evidence we need. Look at the American population. They've been exposed to GMOs commercially since 1996.
And look how well they're doing.
Look how well.
Right.
You know, when you look at the science of how proteins, foreign proteins, can be produced through the GMO process, something's been verified, you know, what you'd expect is actually reactions that are inflammatory and allergic. And those inflammatory reactions, of course, underpin all the major chronic diseases, of which there is an epidemic. So essentially the noise of GMO, if it was occurring, would be completely and utterly masked by the general trend in increasing chronic diseases linked to sedentary lifestyles and simplification of diets.
That's very well said. Because, you know, so how do we know what is causing this epidemic of degenerative diseases? There's such a multiplicity of factors, it's hard to pick it out. So we say, look, you know, epidemiological studies show there's no problem whatsoever, but how can we pick apart the factors?
Exactly. It is. We know the diseases are multifactorial. We know that GMOs would be linked to exactly the same kind of symptoms, and it's impossible to separate out the two. So it is. It's a classic uncontrolled experiment, just like fluoridation of the water supply. I mean, you guys are still dealing. That's a fascinating issue because you're still dealing with, and that's one of our campaign issues, very central issue at the moment in Europe as well as the UK. Again, stands pretty much alone with Ireland as a country that wants to fluoridate more and more of the water. And yet the Cochrane review just published last month, the latest review, is basically saying that the evidence is really non-existent, high quality evidence, because, you know, we've been, or governments have been, reliant on evidence that exists prior to 1971, when, you know, fluoridation of oral care products, toothpaste, rinses, etc., came onto the market. They've relied on those old data. What this Cochrane review says is that all of those data are so extraordinarily biased, you can't make head or tail of them.
I think you can blame Britons drive to fluoridate their water on Austin Powers because of just bad dental hygiene. You know, Britain's notorious for bad dental. That's the part of the running joke in the Austin Powers movies. So this is a good point at which to pause because, you know, we've covered European regulatory framework. Is it worse? Is it better? In some ways better, in some ways worse. Is it coming our way in the United States? We better beware of harmonization and globalization. When we return in part two, we divide these podcasts into two parts. Many of you listeners are aware of that. We're going to discuss what it's like to find a complementary and alternative practitioner in Great Britain, which, as many of you know, operates under a single-payer medical system, socialized medicine with the National Health Service. Is it easier? Is it harder? What does that mean for reform-minded Americans? Should we be careful what we wish for? I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's guest is Dr. Rob Verkerk. He's scientific director of ANH International and executive director for ANH Europe, the Alliance for Natural Health. Rob, what's the website?
The website is anh-europe.org. The U.S. one is anh-usa.org.
Okay. Great organization. We'll be right back. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.